Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast today with Dr. Leo Galland, who is an internationally recognized leader in integrated medicine. He is the developer of the PillAdvise.com website and author of the weekly PillAdvise newsletter, and currently is training his sights on the very, very enigmatic problem of Lyme disease. He's got an upcoming webinar, which we'll share information with you about. And in part one, if you go back to part one, we define the problem. The problem is clearly much more pervasive than is admitted by health authorities in America. The question is, when people get treated for Lyme disease with the usual recommended treatment, do they always get well? Well, apparently not. What's going on? Do they still have Lyme disease or is something else happening? That's been the subject of Dr. Galland's inquiries over the past few months as he really drills down on the problem. So give us the details once again on the webinar.
You can access it by going to PillAdvise.com and looking at the blog that on the Lyme disease webinar. That's PillAdvise.com, or by checking out the article on HuffPost about Lyme disease on the in the Healthy Living section, the blog that I've written there. Which should be a featured blog right now on the Healthy Living front page. The webinar is free, and you can call in with questions. There will be two webinars, the first one on June 11th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, will be an overview on the problem of Lyme disease, and we'll look at some of the things that we talked about in the first part of this podcast. And beyond that. And the second webinar will deal with advanced treatment issues and especially deal with this very difficult question of what happens when people don't get better and why does that occur?
And I don't want to steal your thunder for the webinar, but you know clearly a couple of main possibilities. One, and conventional medicine doesn't recognize chronic Lyme disease. Their contention is that mostly when you take those antibiotics for 3 weeks, you kill the Lyme disease, so that whoever feels sick afterwards, that's just the aftermath of Lyme disease, and the Lyme disease has been successfully eradicated. But are you open to the possibility that people have chronic infections that respond poorly to antibiotics?
Right. Well, first of all, the statement that I don't believe in chronic Lyme disease, that's a religious statement.
Right.
You know, that's like saying, I don't believe in the devil or something.
Right, right.
There, I mean, any infection can be chronic, and Lyme is the Borrelia species, the genus Borrelia and the various species within it are spirochetes. This is the same family as syphilis. These are very slow-growing organisms that characteristically can cause chronic infections. So the notion, and late-stage Lyme disease has been thoroughly described. So the notion that you can't have chronic Lyme disease is, it's unscientific and absurd. The real question is, does this person have a chronic infection which can respond to antibiotic therapy? That's the only meaningful question in that context of chronic Lyme disease.
And clinically, it's a really important question because when we see patients where we entertain that possibility, we're also cautious about administering antibiotics long-term because we recognize that they're not a free ride, that long-term intensive antibiotic therapy can bring with it adverse consequences, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. My background was I had seen so many people whose health had been damaged by antibiotics that I was very skeptical about getting into treatment protocols where one had to use long-term antibiotics. But, I mean, the fact is there are some infections where that's necessary, and there are some infections where multiple antibiotics are necessary. And so the idea that, well, you're just going to, that you can just cure this infection with one antibiotic in over 3 weeks, you know, that may happen, but it also may not happen. And right now we don't have enough data to be certain how often it will happen and with what treatment protocol. But, you know, if you take, tuberculosis, the standard treatment for tuberculosis is at least 6 months and of at least two drugs. H. pylori infection, you know, which causes stomach ulcers, the standard treatment is 2 to 3 antibiotics. And no one would treat that infection with a single antibiotic. So we're going to need more data over time to decide what optimal treatments are for Lyme. Although I have to say, my belief is the main rule when it comes to treating Lyme disease is that there are no rules except that you have to individualize treatment. And one of the points that I make in this blog, and it is going to be a focus of the second webinar, but I'm happy to talk about it now because it's something that people really need to understand and think about, and I include doctors in that, are the different mechanisms responsible for people who are treated not getting well and not returning to being as healthy as they were before they ever got Lyme disease. I think there are several that we need to look at. The first is the possibility of a co-infection.
Mm-hmm. So you treat the Lyme, you're very effective at treating the Lyme disease. Let's presume that this whatever antibiotic concoction you're using eradicates the Lyme disease. The patient's still sick, but there's another bug that is present and that is not responsive to the antibiotics.
Right, absolutely.
Bugs, plural.
Yeah, we know that these ticks frequently carry parasites, Babesia and filaria, which are worms, are microscopic bloodborne parasitic infections that are carried by Lyme ticks, or other bacteria. Bartonella and anaplasma are two different types of bacteria that may not respond to the treatment for Lyme disease.
And Bartonella, often referred to as cat scratch fever,
well,
is it?
Bartonella henselae is the organism which causes cat scratch fever. That's one of the species of Bartonella. But there are other species as well, and they're not only spread by ticks. That is, lice and fleas may spread them. Trench fever is caused by Bartonella. There are probably 100 species of Bartonella, and they're very tricky because they live intracellularly, and even
like malaria, which is very hard to eradicate.
Right. And Babesia is intracellular and similar to malaria.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you're treating Lyme disease. Maybe you get rid of the Lyme disease, maybe you don't. But there are these co-infections, and the co-infections actually have been shown to be immune suppressive. That is, people who have ehrlichiosis, which is caused by anaplasma, and then get Lyme disease, they're immune suppressed and they don't mount the same response. Bartonella is known to produce immune suppression. And so the reason that the person might not get over the Lyme disease is because they have a co-infection, and it's more important to treat the co-infection when the person is sick than it actually is to deal with Lyme. That can wait till later. A second mechanism is something called bacterial persistence. Now, this is different from resistance. With resistance, the bacteria don't respond to the antibiotic. With persistence, the bacteria would be killed by the antibiotic if you were testing it in a culture medium, but the bacteria has found ways to hide so that the antibiotic can't get to it. It may do this by going into places in the cell called vacuoles that the antibiotics don't penetrate into. It may do it by forming biofilms, and it may do it by going into a very slow growing form. Antibiotics basically just kill fast growing cells. Some of these look like they're cysts when it comes to Lyme disease. So
almost like a spore form, where something becomes inactive.
Something similar to a spore that the antibiotic can't penetrate. That and Lyme, additionally, is very good at hiding from your immune system. One of the reasons that large animals like horses and cows and deer don't get sick from Lyme disease is a protein called complement. Complement is part of the innate immune response, and the innate immune response is the first line of defense against infection. It doesn't depend on recognizing the organism forming specific antibodies. It's a general way of recognizing patterns of foreign bugs. It doesn't matter which bug it is, and killing it. And the complement in these large animals is very effective at killing the Lyme organism on contact rapidly. Now, human complement doesn't do such a good job. And it's kind of variable. And that's because Lyme has found a way to kind of sidestep human complement, to inactivate it or avoid its antimicrobial effects. And that might explain why some people get sick and others don't when they have the same exposures, because it is kind of variable. It varies from Lyme organism to Lyme organism, and it may vary from person to person.
Right. In other words, it's two different people might be bitten by the same tick and acquire different infections or have a different outcome.
Right.
One might respond beautifully to the 3 weeks of antibiotics, and another with maybe challenged immune system or less than optimal immune system might have a chronic infection or difficulty eradicating the bugs. So what about, what is another reason for the persistence of symptoms?
Okay, there may not be a live organism. There may be bacterial debris. This is what a lot of the anti-chronic Lyme academics favor, is that there's, and have demonstrated in mice, for example, that there's bacterial debris that is not really live, but is capable of provoking an immune response.
Mm-hmm.
A fourth mechanism is autoimmunity, and this actually has been pretty well documented, that in some people, Lyme disease acts as a trigger for an autoimmune response.
Mm-hmm.
And once, even if the trigger is gone, the autoimmune response continues.
Right, it's just, it got turned on. It's sort of like, if a forest fire is started by an arsonist and you capture the arsonist, the fire will persist nonetheless, even though
Right. Nobody's
putting gasoline on the fire anymore. So,
right.
I think
that argument is valid, and you need to look beyond infection, but you can't exclude infection.
So is there room for, it sounds, to some extent, antibiotics are the only answer for people suffering from chronic Lyme, but obviously you draw on a vast resource of your own personal experience using diet and specific supplements, ingenious use of different types of medications to bring people back to health. Do you think that's an important part of the Lyme equation, not just bombing people with antibiotics?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, in fact, one of the next mechanism of persistent symptoms are the side effects of the antibiotics. And there are two types of side effects that I think are really important. One is the dysbiosis and yeast overgrowth, and that are caused by being on antibiotics. There was this very interesting study done in Germany where they took a handful of patients who had been treated for Lyme disease, and they hadn't gotten better, despite pretty extensive antibiotic therapy. And so they put them all on fluconazole, Diflucan, an anti-yeast medication, for 28 days. And 75% of them had all their symptoms resolved.
Wow, that is a very impressive vindication of the yeast connection theory,
right,
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Now, it absolutely is. Now, the German author said, well, he thought that the Diflucan was actually killing the Lyme organism.
Mm.
I have not seen a shred of evidence to support that theory.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty clear to me that these people had developed yeast problems and that's what needed to be addressed at that stage in time. The other thing about antibiotics, which is true for the strong antibiotics that are what are called bactericidal, that actually kill the organisms, they are damaging to mitochondria. Now, the mitochondria are these little components of each cell that are the energy-generating powerhouses in the cell. And mitochondrial damage can cause fatigue, muscle weakness, cognitive dysfunction. And so I think part of the philosophy of treatment has to be that if you're going to put patients on antibiotics and their symptoms don't improve, you need to find ways, and these are mostly going to be nutritional ways, to support mitochondrial function.
So these and other strategies are going to be grist for the mill in your upcoming webinars, and we don't want to steal your thunder because there's lots more information to share, and people will be able to do that in an interactive way on the 11th and on the 25th, and also you'll be able to access the archive podcast on the subject of Lyme disease. You have certainly done yeoman service by focusing your attention on this important problem in your usual comprehensive fashion, scholarly fashion, trying to uncover the mystery of chronic Lyme disease, and also the key to getting a lot of patients well who weren't suspected of having Lyme disease, because we may be just seeing the tip of the iceberg of the epidemic, as you point out.
I think we are just seeing the tip of the iceberg, as these two studies that I cited earlier indicate. This is a major public health problem.
Indeed it is.
And I'm really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about it.
So once again, Pill Advise is the place to go. Lots of useful resources there, plus some leads on the Lyme webinar, the upcoming Lyme webinar. And people can subscribe to your newsletter there as well to be updated on events and happenings related to things that you're pursuing.
Okay, well, yeah, I'm really looking forward to be able to present this information and to interact with the people that are able to call in.
Excellent. Yeah, I want to recommend it very highly to our listeners. Thank you very much, Dr. Leo Galland. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.